We all know that there are other countries that are beating our pants off academically, but why is that so? And what can we do to learn from, mimic, and catch up to them? Journalist Amanda Ripley found an ingenious way to answer those questions and more. The result is her best-selling book, The Smartest Kids in the World. In this podcast, we talk with Ripley about her methods, her conclusions, and what the rest of the world can teach America about education reform. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, it's great having you. Well, first, tell us about the idea for this book, because it's a little confusing. Your previous book was Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes. This sounds like a bit of a departure.
You don't see that as a natural segue?
I mean, connect the dots for us.
I used to cover crime and terrorism and disasters for Time. And then somewhere along the way...
And some people would say the American education system is a disaster.
I knew I could set you up for that. Nice. And somewhere along the way, I wrote an education story and I realized, oh man, this is way more interesting than I thought. I had sort of unfairly decided that education was one of these impossible, you know, squishy problems that you would never find a foothold in. And it turns out it was much more, I mean, I don't need to tell you. I mean, it's full of conflict and narrative and characters and data and all the things that make for great storytelling. So I, for the past 5 years, have gotten pretty sucked into education. And, you know, there are no similarities really between the two books, except that both are about the disconnect between what policy thinks people will do and what people actually do. So, so that is always interesting. But this book really came out of the mystery that we all kind of wonder about, which is, what, you know, how did these countries get so smart? I mean, these countries we hear about in the news every few years, Finland and Korea and Singapore. I mean, these countries were not intellectual powerhouses when our grandparents were born. So Finland had a 10% high school graduation rate in the 1950s. And now is it 90%? And when you look at the change, the movement around the world in education outcomes, it really is exciting. I mean, it's hopeful, actually, in a way that sometimes it's not when you're thinking about it within the U.S.
Well, let's talk about just some of the initial criticisms people make. They say, look, first of all, it doesn't matter. American test scores have been mediocre forever. And we still dominate the world economically, politically. We still, you know, more Nobel Prize winners, innovation, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates. This is where it's at, Amanda. Don't you love America?
I love America so much that I actually feel like this is a serious crisis. And I don't feel like, I mean, it is easy to exaggerate. It is easy to exaggerate. So let's not do that, okay?
Yeah.
We are not the worst. We are solidly average. We do better, much better in reading than we do in math and science, which is encouraging.
Right.
We do a lot of things very well in certain states and certain classrooms, certain schools. So the sky isn't falling. But it is also true that there are now 20 countries that have higher high school graduation rates than we do. It is also true that though we are a very wealthy country, the wealth is not distributed. And so it is very hard now to be a poor person in the United States the way that it's not. In fact, if I had to be a poor person, I would be a poor person in Finland, right? Or Canada. There was a UK politician who said, if you want the American dream, go to Finland. And that just is like a knife to the heart, you know? Yeah. So that's the kind of thing that we need to work on.
But then that's the other thing that people say is it's poverty. You know, the reason that our scores are relatively low is because of poverty. If we had less poverty, if we had a Finnish style social safety net, then our test scores would be fine. The schools aren't the problem.
I'm all for less poverty. That would be awesome. But what you see around the world is that these things interact, right? You have to hold multiple ideas in your head at once. So if you look at a country like Norway, which has less than 6% child poverty, much like Finland, among the lowest poverty rates in the world, also is one of only three countries to spend more than we do on K through 12 education per pupil, and is a place that, you know, has a pretty generous safety net, in fact. Norway has consistently mediocre education outcomes, much like that of the United States. So you see variance that has something to do with poverty, for sure, but that isn't the only constant.
All right. So in this book, you find a very clever way to look beyond just the test scores that we've been talking about, or, you know, boring case studies of governance arrangements like we've published here as a think tank at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. But you find this very this great way to get at the narrative, and it is the exchange student.
Yes.
So how did that idea come to you? It's brilliant.
Well, thank God for these kids. I mean, every year there's 30,000 teenagers who essentially trade places, who come to the United States and go to public school and live with a family, or leave the United States and go to public school somewhere else and live with a family. And this is a sort of untapped resource, these amateur anthropologists mm-hmm. who, you know, they don't have the whole picture, but they can, in a very profound but narrow way, compare what they see in their town in Oklahoma to their town in Finland. And that, combined with the research, really helped me get a fuller picture. Because, I mean, honestly, I don't know if you ever feel this way, but I got tired of hearing these platitudes about mm-hmm. Finland and how everything's perfect all the time. And I just didn't believe it. Like, it just didn't seem vivid to me. So yeah. I wanted to know, you know, what is it like to be a kid in these places? And the only way to know that mm-hmm. or even have a, you know, vague glimpse of that is yeah. through kids themselves.
Now, but it is a narrow slice, and the kids don't have the context. And so how do you deal with that? I mean, social scientists would say, what can we take from this? It's right. three kids that you're
right.
following.
Right.
So what?
So a couple things. There's almost nothing from their story that isn't also affirmed by research. Mm-hmm. So there are things that happened to them that I don't tell you about, because I do think it's just sort of a freak, you know, mm-hmm. one-off. And there's no evidence that it's reflective of a broader mm-hmm. trend in the data. Mm-hmm. There is great data now, as I don't need to tell you, about international comparisons, but it's not perfect. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of blind spots. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I did to try to fill in some of those blind spots was that I surveyed hundreds of exchange students as well to try to see if there were patterns. And mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, I mean, by the consensus. Mm. For whatever it's worth, for example, 9 out of 10 international exchange students said classes were easier in the U.S. mm-hmm. than back home. And 7 out of 10 American exchange students agreed the yeah. classes were easier here. So there were some patterns. You know, it wasn't a huge sample. I would love to see a bigger
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I do feel like the combination mm-hmm. of the research and the kids' stories is important.
Yeah. All right. So you picked Finland, Korea, and Poland. Why those three?
Well, Finland is the utopia, right? The holy grail we always hear about. Everything's perfect. Everybody's blonde and tall, and there's no problems, and there's not testing, and there's no grading, and there's no tiers and everything. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I had to go. I mean, you have to go there, right?
Yeah, right.
And then that's the sort of utopia model. South Korea is a very different model, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe the opposite in some right. ways, although they get to the same point through a much more grueling path. And that is the pressure cooker model right. of Asia. And Korea is interesting because it's kind of an extreme case. Mm-hmm. You know, in Singapore, they say, well, at least we're not South Korea. You know, we have a lot of crazy high pressure testing and kids, but we're not South Korea. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go to that extreme, right, to see what mm-hmm. that looked like. Poland is the surprise case, right, that you hear less about. Poland was interesting because it has a 15% child poverty rate, and it's a big country with a lot of distrust for the central government for good reason.
Yep.
And a lot of trauma in its past between communism and World War II and on and on. So it is in some ways more interesting to mm-hmm. the United States because mm-hmm. it is more fraught. And yet they've seen a dramatic improvement in their education outcomes in the past 10 years. So mm-hmm. it's hopeful.
You know, Poland's interesting for all the reasons you say. It does make me wonder this question about causation or correlation. And I've pushed Paul Peterson and Ludger and Eric Hanuschek were on one of our podcasts. I pushed them on this question about, you know, take a place like Poland. Are the scores going up because Poland is booming and the economy is, they're much richer than they were 10 years ago, you know, so that is lifting the academic achievement, or is the relationship the other way? They make this strong case that no, it's that the education improves first and that leads to economic growth. Do you buy that?
I think things interact. I don't think you can ever say with 100% certainty what's causing what. Yeah. But the fascinating thing about PISA is they have this before after snapshot. So in 2000, they took the first PISA. They were yeah. part of that, which, as you know, is a test given to 500,000 15-year-olds in 70 countries every 3 years. And it's yeah. really designed to test critical thinking and math, reading, and science. So they did that. And then at the same time, they were going through all these reforms. Mm-hmm. So by 2003, those reforms were in place. So they had a sample from 2000 of 15-year-olds in the before group, and then in 2003, the after group. And they saw significant growth. So it couldn't just be, I would assume, economic opportunity that suddenly those kids are just waking up to the potential of having a nice car and working much harder. I think it has to be more than that. And then you see continued gains with Poland over the years. So it's pretty interesting. In fact, this didn't make the book because it just came out about a month ago, but the PISA for adults, the PIAAC test, another terrible acronym that's just unfortunate, but this test of adult literacy skills, what you see is so interesting if you break it down by generation. What you see is older Americans doing great relative to older people around the world, trouncing older Poles, for example, in literacy and numeracy. But if you look at younger Americans, you see younger Poles vastly outperforming younger Americans. So that's age 16 to 24. So what you see is really those PISA results being reflected in the adult scores, which is interesting.
You know, Bill Bennett used to say that the older students got in school in America, the worse they did compared to the rest of the world. Actually, now we have the opposite, right? The older our adults get, the better they do. So we'll have to work that one out. Okay, let's dig in. Let's start talking about your informants, these exchange students. So, you know, how did you find these particular three kids that you followed and start to tell us about them? We've got, what is it, Kim, Eric, and Tom.
Yes, they were great. I'm so glad you asked me about them because they saved my life in many ways over and over again, actually, because they kept me focused on things that actually mattered to them as students. And I'm too old to remember that. So it was really important to have them. And you know, honestly, I was initially using them to make the book interesting. And I was, oh, this will be kind of fun, whatever. But they became true protagonists in the book in a way that I hadn't anticipated. I mean, remarkably insightful, patient, wise young Americans, which is important because you have to remember it takes a lot of courage to, as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, step out and go to a country. It's not like they were going to like Italy, you know what I'm saying? So these are challenging countries to live in, challenging languages to learn. So I feel like it's kind of cool that these are young Americans at their best in many ways. At the same time, the book is critical of our education system. The kids were really important. So Kim came from rural Oklahoma. She'd never left the United States. She went to a school with not great outcomes, with significant level of poverty. Her mom was a teacher, single mother, who also had never left the country. But Kim just really had this craving to see the world. She didn't really fit in her town. She wanted to be somewhere else for whatever combination of teenage reasons. And so she read that Finland had the smartest kids in the world, and she said, that's where I want to go. So she raised $10,000 all by herself and was sent to rural Finland, as it turns out, to live with another single mother in a different town very far away.
Wow. And about her experience at her school. So it you know, by judging by test scores, it was not a great school. What was her experience like? Was she being challenged? Was the school trying to get better? What was that?
Her experience was good in English class. She liked some of her English classes. She loved reading and talking about books. She had a very hard time in math, which, you know, is unique to her in some ways and not in others. Math is really the subject that is an American weakness at every socioeconomic level. So in that sense, I did go into some detail on that in the book because it's reflective of a broader situation. She felt very frustrated, felt like she just wasn't good in math. Ironically, her mother was a math teacher. All kinds of issues there. But she often felt like the real heartbeat of the school was sports. And I know we were eventually going to get around to this, but she felt like she just didn't connect with the things that mattered most. She tried, to her credit. You know, she was a cheerleader and she tried to join the band, but it never quite worked out for her. So she always kind of felt like she was on the margins of what mattered in her town.
Okay. Fascinating. Eric. Very different story.
Eric might as well have been coming from a different country as Kim. I mean, and this is why it's important, I think, to think about the United States as if it's 50 countries, particularly when it comes to education. Eric came from a suburb of Minneapolis in Minnesota, one of our highest performing states in the country. He went to within Minnesota, one of the best performing high schools in the country, a very well-resourced suburban affluent school where he was on the International Baccalaureate track.
he had pretty much the best we have to offer, at least on paper. And he went from there, God love him, to South Korea, which, so he went really from the top of the United States to the top of the world. Mm-hmm. Very, very different situation. Yep. And pretty much regretted it right away in some ways. Right.
I mean, that became clear in the book. He hated South Korea.
He loved Koreans and he loved Korea. Yeah. He just hated Korean school.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to get into all that. All right. And then finally, Tom. Tom was your last protagonist. He's the one who goes to Poland.
Yeah. Tom grew up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, but from the beginning was sort of an alti kid. Like he, you know, he liked to watch Woody Allen movies and listen to Sonic Youth. And, you know, he played the cello and.
God, he sounds so much cooler than we are.
I know. It was very intimidating. Yeah. To interview Tom, he was constantly, you know, making references that I didn't get, and I'd be like, right, right, no, really great guy, and he was really into, you know, philosophy and Eastern European literature, so he wanted to also to get out of his town for his senior year of high school, and he thought it would be, I mean, he had this romantic idea, really, that if he went to, you know, Poland, he could spend his afternoons in smoke-filled coffee shops reading philosophy, and, you know, to his credit, he actually did that. I mean, he took me to smoke-filled coffee shops, and there were philosophy books, and so he pulled it off and ended up in Wrocław, Poland for a year.
Wow. Awesome. All right. So they head over there and you go catch up with them in the fall to kind of check in and see how they're doing. So let's talk first about Finland. Is it this utopia that we have heard of? It's this wonderful, kind place, great schools. What did you see?
Well, Kim was sort of taken aback on her first day when she first saw the school. Sort of dreary, gray building. There's a clock out front that had clearly stopped working years ago. It wasn't exactly the IKEA paradise that she had imagined. But
let's be clear. Is IKEA actually finished?
No, but I feel like Americans won't know the difference. Right. We're fine. Yeah, we're totally good.
Swedish.
Yes. So it wasn't exactly as she pictured. But as time went by, there were things she began to really appreciate. The obvious things were that she had more freedom. She had more autonomy. And this is actually something that when I surveyed hundreds of exchange students.
In the school, you mean?
Both, interestingly.
In and out of school.
Like in their host family and in the school. And that's something you hear a lot from exchange students. They feel much more constrained, just to generalize, in American schools and homes. I'm sure there's a lot of reasons for that. Hmm. But it's also the case that even though she was in a little town in Finland called Pietarsaari, she could walk to the village and she just had a lot more freedom in a way that she did in America.
She wasn't in some sprawled out suburb without public transportation.
Exactly. And, right, yeah.
Gotcha. And in school as well that she could get around and she could.
Yeah. And, you know, it's more like college, you know, if you had a free period, you could leave. And she said it took her a while. She'd be sort of slinking around waiting to get busted, you know, before she realized it was okay. You know?
Yeah. So what is she? So she starts, you know, she's in there and she's, you know, learning the language and she's seeing the teaching and learning. And I mean, is it, it's as good as they say it is? What?
One of the things Americans notice when they go to Finland, and this I think is fair to say includes teachers and education experts more so than Kim, a student, is that they see a lot in high school, especially a lot of lecturing. Like it doesn't look like you expect it to look. You don't see kids, you know, creating dances and international global debates, and they aren't constantly interacting. So that comes as sort of a surprise. Now, Kim actually really liked her classes, and it took her obviously some time to catch to catch the finish.
Yeah.
But she felt like, you know, what was interesting, and this is where it was very valuable to follow kids, she was much more attuned to what her peers were like than I would have been very focused on the teacher and the curriculum. And, which she was. She really liked her teachers in Finland, and she talked a lot about that. But she felt like the kids in her classes cared more about school. They seemed to be bought into the system in a way that even the kids in her honors classes in Oklahoma were not. And this really baffled Kim. She couldn't understand why it was, because she could tell that the kids were otherwise pretty similar. You know, like they were texting when they weren't supposed to in class, and they were on Facebook and they played video games, and they weren't sort of intellectual heavyweights. They complained about some of their teachers and their homework. But they seem to be kind of just committed to the idea mm-hmm. that what they were doing in school all day would impact how interesting their lives would be.
Hmm. Interesting.
And this is something that all three kids notice and obviously hugely important.
Right. So a lot of that motivation. And yet what you were saying before is that it wasn't like it was more enjoyable. I mean, they're sitting and listening to lectures.
No, in fact, when Finnish kids are surveyed internally, they complain actually about the number of tests they have to take. Mm-hmm. Now, these aren't standardized tests.
Yeah.
These are classroom tests, but they take a lot of tests in high school. There's a lot of pressure on kids because the high school exit exam is extremely rigorous. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of thing hanging over their head. And it's not all kind of games and fun. Not to say I didn't see that. I mean, I did see that in many classrooms. Mm-hmm. And you see more of that in the younger grades. Mm-hmm. In Finland, there's a lot of play and recess mm-hmm. and so forth. But by high school, it's pretty serious.
Yeah. All right. Let's skip over to South Korea. As you mentioned before, this was not in a place, the schools at least, that Eric turned out to be crazy about. We've gotten a little taste of this from, you know, reading books about Michelle Rhee, for example, spending a year over there. And, you know, people might have seen other that this is a that call a pressure cooker is exactly right.
It's a strange paradox because the Korean kids, I mean, just to generalize wildly, were the most joyful, happy, extroverted group of kids I ever met. I mean, they literally are just so excited to see you. There's a lot of energy. You know, I mean, they want to take your picture and give you their email address and talk to you. And so it was really fun to meet them. But then as soon as you sat them down and started talking about school, it was like all the fun sucked out of the room, you know? So there is an interesting contrast internally there.
Yeah. You write in the book a lot about, of course, the cram schools, which is a big feature in South Korea. So the kids go to school during the day. But then because there is this meritocratic system of colleges, I mean, you really, really, really want to get into the best colleges. Parents who can afford at least pay for these after school cram schools, and kids spend all afternoon and night doing more school.
It's crazy. Three quarters of Korean 15-year-olds go to after-school tutoring, test prep of some kind or another. This is not on the order of what happens in the United States. The United States is about 15%, and it's not nearly a sophisticated market like it is in Korea. So basically, these are like just second schools that have all the same subjects that you took all day long, but they're private. And so kids go to them until late at night. There's actually a curfew now in many cities in Korea, so that as a way to kind of tamp down on this madness, so they have to shut down by 11 p.m. And so it is very inefficient, and everyone in Korea complains about this because when you walk into a Korean high school, you see in many classrooms, you know, a third of the kids sleeping because they're so tired from staying up so late studying, which is crazy. So it is... I think there are some really interesting lessons from Korea, but no one would argue that it's a model for the U.S.
And Eric decides quickly he doesn't like this at all. Is it because of that, because of this pressure cooker aspect?
Right. He really likes the kids. He really likes the culture, the food. He's totally game, Eric. Like he's really adventurous and he loves to talk. But he can't have a social life because none of the kids have a social life at this age because they're all getting ready for the test. And there's all this focus on the test. And so, you know, he's not really doesn't care about the test. And so there's kind of a disconnect, and he finds it pretty sad. I mean, he thought he knew about high stakes testing. I mean, he thought he knew about pressure.
Right.
And he realized there's this whole other league that he did not know about.
Interesting. And then finally, Tom in Poland. Any particular insights there?
Tom notices on the very first day, much like Kim, that school is just a little more serious in Poland, but there's no frills. I mean, and this was true in every country. The facilities are typically not super impressive. The kids all noticed there were typically less education technology in the classroom, fewer smart boards, fewer laptops, etc. Poland is probably the extreme case. I mean, Poland spends 50% per student what we spend on K-12. And so not only are there not smart boards or laptops, there's not a cafeteria, you know, I mean, there's not a field. I mean, it's just bare bones. And this was at a high school considered to be pretty good. So, you know, there's a real kind of a seriousness, but it's very focused on kind of old school learning. Mm-hmm.
So you keep coming back to that, that it's serious, big focus on learning, a big focus on value and education. And you just write in the book that you think this has something to do with the histories of these countries.
Well, I think it has to do with how they've changed their education systems. I think there are a lot of reasons why kids are taking education more seriously in these countries, but one reason is that it is more serious. So let me give you an example. In South Korea, on the day of the big high school exam, like the SAT, the stock exchange opens an hour late so that there isn't as much traffic for the kids to get to the testing sites. Now think about the signal that that sends, right?
Right.
To kids about how important this is. In Finland, the kids know that getting into ed school is as hard as getting into MIT in the US, that you have to score in the top 10% right now on the SAT equivalent to get into any of the colleges that train teachers. They may not like all their teachers, but they know that.
They
have like street cred, you know, because we're not just saying teaching is hard and education is important, but they're acting like it.
Yeah.
And they know that. And in Poland, the kids wear suits and ties on the days they have their big tests. I mean, so there are lots of things going on, and those are just anecdotes. But kids, I think, one thing I sort of had forgotten is that kids are really sensitive to signals. Like, kids know when something is bogus and when it's for real.
Interesting. You know, I was with David Steiner the other day. He's the dean of the Ed School at Hunter College, former commissioner of education in the state of New York. He grew up in England, and you know, he said, look, in America, you have this idea that learning is supposed to be fun, that childhood is supposed to be fun. People don't have those ideas in the rest of the world. You know, they just accept that, school is going to be grueling. It's going to be hard. It's not always going to be enjoyable. Suck it up, kids. It's going to be worth it someday. I mean, is that some of what you've seen in these other countries as well, that we've romanticized this idea of what our kids are supposed to experience?
Well, in a way, at the same time, there are lots of countries that have this kind of hardcore old school attitude that, you know, isn't all about fun, that don't have good results. I mean, like France, Italy, Spain, these are all pretty rigid structures in the classroom, and they don't get good results. So Germany didn't get good results until fairly recently. These are things that I think interact, again, not to repeat myself, but Finland in particular is not a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
So there's something
else. But
you're
also saying that they're lecturing. They're not, you know, they're not worried about trying to put on a big show for the kids or having them, you know, be a lot of experiential learning necessarily, where they're, doing more progressive kinds of techniques.
I think the trick in Finland has to do with quality over quantity.
Yeah.
So their kids are working hard, but they do less homework than American kids. Just the homework is more, adding more value. So,
and that comes back again and again. I've heard you talk about this, that it's about making the intellectual work just harder, not more of it, right?
Right.
Not more exercises and dittos and fill in the blank, but actually more intellectually challenging. So how do we do that in America? I mean, how do we try to get to the point where we're just getting kids on a daily basis to do work that is just more intellectually taxing?
Right. It seems like particularly in math, we're kind of systematically underestimating what kids can do. And there's a lot of evidence for that, as you know. So that's something that is particularly urgent. I actually think the Common Core is a step in the right direction for this reason, because it allows, it provides coherence and clarity. And it's hard to really have rigorous, interesting work worth doing if you don't have that coherence and clarity. So every education superpower country has the equivalent of a Common Core. I mean, it's just a prerequisite. So that is encouraging to me. But I also think, look, you know, you have to make teacher training more selective and more rigorous if you want the homework to be more challenging and engaging. There's just no way around that that I know of. And there's not a single country in the top of the world that isn't more selective in its teacher education than we are.
Right. Well, wouldn't it be hard to be more selective than we are, right? Since we literally have no selection criteria in some states, or extremely limited ones, right? So you do. You buy that argument that a lot of this has got to be about raising the bar on teachers. There's been some movement in recent months on that. So maybe we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. All right. A couple more questions, man. So when you've looked around the world, does it give you any appreciation for some things that we're actually doing well that we would want to protect as we think about reform?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. One of the things that the exchange students I surveyed brought up on their own was how much they liked their American teachers. Mm. I mean, they weren't saying, yeah, I'm learning a ton. They were saying, I like this person. This person cares about me. And it's easy to forget how rare that is around the world. Obviously, it's
not. Is that important?
You know, I think kids respond well to trust, just like any relationship. Like if there's rapport, then that can help, right? It's not, but it's not enough. So I think that our more interactive classrooms, that is a huge strength when combined with rigorous learning, right? Because if we're trying to teach kids to think for themselves, to make an argument, you know, to write, those kinds of higher order skills, they need to be able to talk when they have something to say. They need to be able to interact. But it has to be also combined with rigorous work.
Now, I have made the argument that perhaps one of the reasons that our country does well economically, et cetera, that there's still a lot of innovation is it's not because of what happens inside the schools, it's what happens after school, that actually we have a great tradition of extracurricular activities, sports and music and the glee club and the bands and all of that kind of stuff where kids learn hard work, teamwork, excellence, competition, all these things that make up part of the American culture. I mean, and versus having South Korean kids in cram school all afternoon and all night.
And the exchange student talk about that. They love that there was so much to school, that they had yearbook and French club and all these things that they could do. And it wasn't just about learning.
So Amanda, why are you trying to get rid of sports?
Here we go. Let's go.
Come on.
So I think that's awesome. And that is something we should, I don't see it, by the way, despite no matter what I write, it's never going to change. So let's just say that to begin with. But it's about balance.
Yeah.
It's about taking a step back and saying, are we being honest with our kids when we are glorifying, truly glorifying?
Yeah.
The performance of athletes in certain sports
and glee club members. they got a TV show, Amanda.
Would that glee club members were getting the adulation of football players. When we are doing that and it's so out of balance with, it's not like we're like, you know, being equal with the debate club. Maybe that should be the new Title IX, right? Like instead of just about gender, it should be, well, okay, are we spending as much mental and financial energy on the kinds of really fun and interesting skills that will actually yield returns for kids their whole lives.
I think debate club under the lights is a great idea, Amanda. We should try that.
Honestly, this is like in Korea, the only way to get into the newspaper as a kid, unless you kill someone, is to do something amazing academically.
Yeah.
That's the only way.
Now,
all over this country, the way to get into the newspaper is through sports.
Right.
All over this country, there are the sports, there are entire sections dedicated to high school sports in the newspapers.
Right.
So if we're going to do that, you know, there should be some kind of balancing out of that.
But it also seems, and you've made this point, is that the lesson is, first of all, our young people are up for a good challenge. They're up for working hard.
Totally.
Right. We know that. I mean, they are, we see these young athletes or in these other extracurriculars, people will, you know, these kids will work hard. And if we say, you know what, they can work just as hard when it comes to academics and we can challenge them and they will rise to that challenge and they'll actually enjoy it. That one reason they get so disengaged from school is because it's boring and it's not challenging. And so they just tune out.
Less than half of American high schoolers say they are challenged in most or all of their classes.
Right.
Given the results, that is a travesty. So I wish sometimes we could do like a find replace all of the rituals and practices and mindsets we have towards athletics and just switch them over, or 10% of that over to academics, because you're right. Our kids are killing it in athletics and our parents are honest with their kids about athletics, especially in high school, not so much in elementary school. And and coaches are very direct with kids about their performance in sports, not so much in school.
That's right. All right. Well, this is, again, it's a fantastic book. Everyone should check it out. The Smartest Kids in the World by Amanda Ripley. Amanda, so you've done disasters, you've done education. What's the next book going to be?
I don't know. I think it's time for outer space or something totally, totally different.
Well, I hope we can learn from the Martians about how to improve our education system. That would be another good contribution. All right. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
Thank you very much for having me.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.